So we're looking at the larger Pure Land Sutra, and I just wanted to say a couple of things generally to plug us back into it, because there's quite long gaps in between. So the first is, obviously it's important because it's where Shandao took his inspiration from, and Honen took his inspiration from Shandao's commentary on this for the 18th vow that we looked at last week, that says, all beings who hear my name go to the Pure Land. So it's seen as the main text of Pure Land Buddhism. But there is a big cultural divide between us in the 20th century Britain, 21st century now Britain, and when this was written in ancient India. Which is why we don't give this to beginners. We recommend that they read one of Tayuno's books or Dharmavijja's. So there is a bit of a sort of cultural navigation to get into it, but it's important because it demonstrates a couple of things. The first is that what we looked at in the first couple of weeks, the idea of transmission. Dharmakara is inspired to make these vows that we carry on reading tonight when he meets a spiritual teacher who is shining. And in the sort of prequel to this, Ananda sees that the Buddha is shining, and the Buddha says he's seeing Buddhas all around him. So not only do we get the sense of meeting a real spiritual teacher in this lifetime, flesh and blood, that can be glowing, lit up like the side of a mountain. Also, when the Buddha is sitting in meditation at the beginning of the sutra, he's communing with something that is accessible to him, even though it's not physically present. And then he goes on to just give this story. And at the heart of the story are these 48 vows, which describe the quality of this presence that he's in touch with. And the story really just gives some narrative to that, and some way of us getting into understanding what that presence is. So we can relate to it either as a picture of the Buddha, you know, the vows describe the Buddha that we're relating to, in terms of Nembutsu, I'm an ordinary being relating to this amazing thing that made these vows, or that these vows attempt to describe. And also, I have some aspiration to become more like that in my life, because we're Pure Land Buddhists, we understand that that happens through grace as much as it does through hard work, or in fact perhaps only through grace. But we can use the vows to measure our depth of faith in the same way that you can use precepts to measure your depth of faith. For example, the vows describe a way of being in the world that we see as sort of 100% holy, pretty much, you know, give or take some cultural differences. So, as far as your life is different from these vows, there's a sort of, that represents a gap in your faith. Because if you had 100% faith and no doubts at all in your unconscious, in your body, you would naturally behave as the Buddha behaves. But actually, even though you may have had an experience of feeling saved by the Buddha, for example, as an ordinary human being, naturally you'll have doubts that go along with that. You'll have habit patterns that remain despite that experience, that turn you back towards self-power and egotism and conceit instead of towards handing over to the Buddha, which naturally leads towards loving behavior. So, for a practical example, we could take the 23rd vow. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, the bodhisattvas of my land, moved by the Buddha's power, cannot honour and reveal all Buddhas everywhere in any part of the universe, and do so in no more time than it takes to eat a morning meal. And the name that Dhammaji is given to this vow is respect for other sanghas. And there's actually two things in it. One is that as a bodhisattva, you should respect other Buddhas. So any spiritual teacher who's teaching love and compassion and wisdom, you should have respect for. even if they've got more followers than your teacher has. Or, you know, whatever it is that pushes your button. I was talking to somebody earlier today where you have two groups that have very similar beliefs. You can actually get a lot more rivalry there than when you've got groups that have got disparate beliefs. So it encourages you to respect spiritual teachers of all traditions. But not only that, it says, moved by the Buddha's power. So if you're aspiring to be a Buddha, you also have to inspire the people around you to respect other teachers. Which again gives us that sense of transmission flowing from one person to another. So, in terms of what I was saying earlier, to the extent that you don't do that, you can understand it as a sort of momentary failure of faith. Because if you're thinking, oh, there's a good spiritual teacher, yeah, I can see what he's talking, makes sense, but actually I'm quite jealous because his robe's nicer than mine, then there's a little bit of ego or selfishness. So you're not, as a container, you're not a completely clear container for faith. And that's to be expected. But I'm sort of saying it's one way that you can work with the vows. So that was the 23rd one. We got as far as the 20th last time, so I'll just skip back. The 21st vow is a little bit more esoteric, so it wouldn't have worked quite so well as a practical example. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas born in my pure land are not each endowed with the 32 marks of a superior being. So this refers to a traditional Indian teaching that beings who are saintly have physical characteristics, mythical beings have these physical characteristics that you can tell by looking at them that they're saints. So they have a Dharma wheel on their feet, for example. And actually, if you look, I think that's one, unless I've just made it up, but let's say that it is. There's these, some of them you see on Buddha Rupas, so very long earlobes, things like that. But there's other ones like golden skin and particular marks that they have on them that show that they're saintly. And I imagine somewhere in ancient history there was a sort of code that said this corresponding mark means this and this means this. And we don't know what that is, but we get the sense that you can tell that somebody is an advanced practitioner when you look at them. And, well, sometimes you can. Anyway, that's something about the cultural difference that I was saying earlier. You know, it's not always easy to grasp the meaning of these vows straight away. The 22nd one is slightly more graspable to us and perhaps more relevant. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, all those reborn in my pure land are not only one more rebirth away from complete nirvana, except for those who choose otherwise and adopt bodhisattva vows. And then it goes on to describe bodhisattva vows. Essentially what it's saying is, the classical understanding of Buddhism is, if you get enlightened, all your karma dissipates and the energy of your life isn't reborn into another life. If you take a bodhisattva vow, you choose to become reborn in one of these ordinary human worlds to guide other beings towards enlightenment. And you can think of that happening over many lifetimes, or you can think of it happening in this lifetime. And actually, when we look at real spiritual practitioners, what we see is, in most cases, their own spiritual, not in most cases, in some cases, their own spiritual development is tangled up in the spiritual development of others. And naturally, as you become closer to enlightenment yourself, you tend to have the effect of enlightening others anyway, even if you're not thinking about it. But some people make a conscious choice that their role is going to be facilitating other people's spiritual growth, as well as and up before their own. And then there's a number of epithets for the bodhisattva vows. The first one is, who don great vow, the armour of great vows for the welfare of the whole world. And what it's saying is, a bodhisattva takes precepts, and those precepts act as protection. And the way they act as protection is, once you've decided that you're going to do something, you don't have to worry about making that decision over and over and over again. You decided that you're not going to eat meat. When you go in a restaurant, you don't need to go through that ethical dilemma each time. You've made the decision. So there's a protection from a particular way of being in the world, which is actually quite ineffective. The vows provide a container for your spiritual life, which allow you to go forth in an effective way. The other epithets are a little bit more obvious. Who are single-mindedly devoted to the well-being of all. Who are dedicated to bringing all living beings to spiritual maturity. It's not a lot to ask. We'll maybe do it by the end of tonight. Who travel freely to practice the Bodhisattva practice in all worlds. Who wish to serve and revere all Buddhas, which links back to the 23rd vow that we mentioned earlier. Who instruct, lead, and transform beings as numerous as sand grains in the Ganges. Lots. And who cultivate the virtues of Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra is a particular Bodhisattva who made vows to go into dark places and help people. And he's often seen riding an elephant with six tusks, which represent the six paramitas. But he's known for going into dark places and helping other people make offerings. Both good things to do. Of course, really, they could have put any Bodhisattva's name there because they're all doing good things all the time. So if you're enlightened, you're naturally doing all these things all the time. And when you're in touch with Amida, and when you're a completely clean container for Amida's light, you'll naturally be inspired to do these as much as you can. But to the extent that your container is cracked so that the inspiration leaks out of you, or contaminated so that it becomes, the light becomes dirty, you'll reach out, you know, you'll try and do these things, but in more dysfunctional ways, which describes everybody here. No offense. So, the 24th vow is respect for the ways of other sanghas, and follows on from the 23rd. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, the bodhisattvas of my land should not manifest their roots of merit and offerings before other Buddhas in forms entirely conforming to what is acceptable and desirable to those Buddhas. So, when you go to a Nichiren temple, you chant Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. When you go to a Zen temple, you sit Sazen. When you come here, you say Nembutsu. What is acceptable and desirable to those Buddhas? So insofar as the other spiritual teachers are asking for things that are acceptable within the Dharma, you take part in those offerings and rituals. So if someone's doing a human sacrifice, that would be a sign that spiritual teacher isn't a Buddha. So this vow doesn't apply to that, so you wouldn't be invited, you know, probably best to abstain from those kind of ceremonies. The 25th vow, comprehensive teaching. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, the bodhisattvas of my land should not expand the Dharma with the same comprehensive knowledge as a fully awakened Buddha. In this context, Dharma doesn't necessarily mean the teachings of the Buddha as they are set out in this form on paper. Although some bodhisattvas will be very conversant with those and able to, you know, transmit them to other people. It means ultimate reality. It means what is true in this moment. It means helping a person with their particular karma. It's about a way of cutting through delusion, not necessarily about using the words in this form, but about speaking what is true. So as bodhisattvas, part of your job is to speak what is true to the same degree that the Buddha does. Again, obviously limited by your own human egos and conceit. The other thing to bear in mind that these vows are describing, they're not, the form of them is describing a Pure Land. So you can think that it's more describing a spiritual community as much as it is a person. So when it talks about the Bodhisattvas, it's talking about figures around a spiritual teacher who are inspired to go out and teach. So in the ideal community, everybody who's around that teacher is inspired to speak the truth. And not only to speak the truth, but also to have what it calls the adamantine body of Narayana. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, the bodhisattvas of my land should not all acquire the adamantine body of Narayana. Who's heard of adamantine?
Adamant?
Yeah, I guess so. Adamantine. Isn't it also what Wolverine's skeleton is made from? And isn't that something like that? Adamantium is close, isn't it? Well, that's an indestructible body, and that's what this is talking about, in a way. You should have a body that's indestructible. You should be tireless. And of course, a bodhisattva is tireless partly because it's a sort of mythical, it's a kind of archetypal ideal, but also because when you're behaving dharmically, you're constantly giving the merit away of what you do. You're not asking for anything back. So somehow that's a much less tiring way of being in the world, actually. People are nodding, so perhaps that's enough to say about that. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, the devas and humans of my land should, even with the divine eye, be able to fathom and know by name and number all the vast extent and diversity of resplendent forms and appearances of objects in that land. So everybody should be able to see how wonderful their surroundings are. That's, I suppose, about practicing gratitude for where you are. And also, if where you are is a Dharma realm, naturally everything will be lit up in a particular way. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas of my land, even those of slight merit, should not be able always to see my Bodhi tree standing radiant and many millions of miles high. So even if you're very far away from the Buddha, you should at least be able to see the tree that he's sitting under. I'm sure we could draw something from that, but it's one of those slightly more esoteric ones. You could say, for example, the Buddha achieved enlightenment when he was sitting under a Bodhi tree. So perhaps what it's saying is that even if you can't see the Buddha all of the time, you should be able to see, even if it's just out the corner of your eye, that spirit of enlightenment. Something like that. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas of my land should not have eloquence and wisdom in sutras, learning, reciting and expounding them. So this is specifically about knowing some of the traditional Buddhist teachings and being able to transmit them to others. And from the point of view of this sutra, that's a good thing to do. And it is, you know, it is a good thing to do. And of course, this sutra wouldn't be here if it weren't for some people at least being able to do that. And if they weren't able to describe the meaning of it eloquently, like Shandao did when Honan was reading about it, it might be sitting on a dusty shelf somewhere, but we wouldn't be here reading and talking about it. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas of my land should not have capacity for limitlessly inspired, wise and eloquent speech. Fairly self-explanatory. In Buddha lands throughout all the ten... I'm just reading halfway through a vow because I was reading from the wrong page. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so my land does not have mirror purity, such that the lands of all other Buddhas, inconceivably countless, throughout the 10 directions, are completely reflected in it. So, you can take this on a number of levels. One is that it's a sort of mystical experience, and you get a sense of everything dharmic being reflected in everything else dharmic, and it may be that that comes to you in a vision, as this describes, seeing lots of Buddha lands, like Queen Vaidehi did when the Buddha went to see her when she was in prison. She had a visual vision of lots of Buddha lands. But it's also saying, we say the Nembutsu is a window onto all the teachings of the Buddha, but any of the Buddhist precepts in the Vinaya, any of the sutras that you read, any Buddhist practice that is a good Buddhist practice, that's also true of. They're all windows onto the whole of the Buddhist teachings. So if you understand, Jiu Kennett said, if you understand one precept, you will understand all the precepts, because all of the precepts are contained within just one. So if you can keep one perfectly, naturally, you'll do all the others. And perhaps the only reason we have so many is because we get bored so easily. And then we could just do one thing over and over and over again. So the next vow is about how the Pure Land looks, and later on in the sutra it's described in more detail, and it's one of those ones where there's a bit of a cultural leap, particularly later on in the sutra. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, in my land, from the ground up to the heavens, the palaces, pavilions, ponds, streams and trees, and all the myriad things of my realm are not all made of substances of exquisite quality, like gems, an aromatic wood, marvellous, refined, fragrant, and surpassing all things human and celestial. And from these delights there does not issue an emanation such that all the bodhisattvas who encounter it adopt thereby the conduct of Buddhas, spreading this effect throughout limitless numbers of world systems. I'm sure lots of different people take this in different ways. The Pure Land is made up of precious substances, and those precious substances inspire the people who encounter them to behave more like Buddhas. So the construction of your community should inspire the people who are there to be kind and loving. So if you go to a Buddhist temple, they're often painted in particular ways, they have rupas around them, so the physical construction, as well as the sort of spiritual construction, there's a reflection in there. So you can take it literally to be take care of your space and make your space nice, as well as make sure that your spiritual community inspires people to behave like Buddhas as well, in terms of the relationships and people, but also take care of your spaces, make sure that your Dharma hall has got a fresh coat of paint. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, beings in all Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who are exposed to my light do not thereby experience a profound mental and bodily peace and replenishment surpassing the pleasures of the heavens. This is really talking about a particular kind of spiritual experience and relief. If you are completely accepted just as you are, that, you know, you can have a very physical, palpable sense of relief, of peace, of feeling recharged. And not only is that sense better than any worldly pleasures, better even than the 85% dark chocolate, it's also better than any of the pleasures that the gods can offer you. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in all Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name do not thereby acquire the Dharma of constancy, unarising and unceasing, the Dharani power, it's like a spell, sufficient, like a magical spell, sufficient to sustain them to their ultimate spiritual goal. So, this is related to the Nembutsu. Beings who listen to my name will receive Dharma, will receive an uprising of Dharma in themselves. That doesn't stop. That is consistent in its delivery. And that will fuel us until we become spiritually mature ourselves, until we feel like we're in the Pure Land all of the time. And the Buddha's always doing that. Now, well, I'll talk about this later on, but I'll also talk about it here, later on in the sutra. If you remember, in terms of the story of the sutra at this point, it's Dharmakara making these vows. He's saying, in the future, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm not going to become enlightened unless any of these conditions, unless my Pure Land matches these conditions. So when the Buddha's finished telling the story, Ananda says to the Buddha, so what, how does it end? Did Dharmakara get enlightened? Did he create his Pure Land? Are these vows being met? And the Buddha says, well, yes. And his name is Amida. And his Pure Land is called Sukhavati, peace and bliss. So now we read these vows with the understanding that actually they're all completed. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in all Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name do not thereby acquire the Dharma of constancy, unarising and unceasing, the Dharani power sufficient to sustain them to their ultimate spiritual goal. Well, that vow has been completed. So the Buddha is now, if you listen, you can hear his name. And if you do listen to his name, these things will be given to you from the Buddha's side, right now in this moment. And the same is true of all the other vows. From the Buddha's side, they've already been completed. O Blessed One, it goes on to say, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, it is not then the case that women in all Buddha lands, throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name, have serene faith, aspire to awakening, and who hate the forms and statuses imposed upon them as women, shall not, on entering my land, be liberated therefrom. This is just a feminist vow. There. And it's significant because even in Buddhism, if you look at Theravadin Buddhism, the most novice monk in any Theravadin order is senior to the most senior. The most novice junior monk is spiritually and hierarchically above the most senior nun. So all the monks and nuns, all the monks there, and then all the nuns lower down. So even if you've been a nun for 30 years, if a novice monk walks through the door who's just been ordained in the morning, the senior nun has to bow to that monk because he's more spiritually enlightened, because he's a man.
Controversial.
So that's why this vow is here, to reset that misunderstanding of Dharma. And Honen, when Honen lived, which was a long time after the Vinaya, 800 years ago in Japan, when Honen lived, it was exactly the same. If you were born into a female body, you weren't going to get enlightened, was the common understanding. You'd what you had to do is practice really, really hard. And if you practice really hard, maybe next time you could be reborn as a man, and then you'd be able to be enlightened. Whereas this sutra says, actually, like the men, all you have to do is listen to the name of the Buddha. So that's good.
I'll stay then.
O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, assemblies of bodhisattvas in all Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions that listen to my name shall not in future lives be empowered to live the pure renunciant life until full awakening. So if you're a bodhisattva in this time, if you would like to take the Arahat road next time, that the homeless life next time around, you can do, and you will be given the sort of spiritual
sustenance.
Perfect, that's the word. Spiritual sustenance to be able to do that. Yeah, to be able to be uprooted. The 37th vow says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in all Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name, prostrate in faith, rejoice, and adopt the bodhisattva way shall not be respected by humans and devas throughout all worlds. And what this says is that if you live a life of faith, naturally other people should respect you. And it says in all worlds, unfortunately. It's hard to tally that with things like, people of faith get assassinated, they get talked down, they don't necessarily inspire respect. But they also inspire respect. And you could understand, you know, the desire to assassinate somebody, either verbally or with a rifle, is the opposite side of respect. But it comes from the same, it comes from that person hitting something in somebody which is important. And it comes out in a, you know, it triggers a particular kind of defense, but there's something about there's definitely a relationship between faith inspiring respect and faith inspiring those kind of defensive responses, which, if you read Dharmavijaya's book, Loving is Disappointment, can also be understood as a dysfunctional, very, very dysfunctional form of respect. Something is touched in that person, but it comes out, it's squeezed through all the layers of disappointment and frustration and anger, to the point where it comes out being destructive. But they've been touched by something still. I'm going to pause there, and I'll pause the tape. And what I will do is just run through all the vows that we've done tonight, like just name what they are as a refresher, and then just to remind people. So then if there's any comments or discussion, you've sort of got them in your mind a little bit more.